Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I talk with Maurice Cherry, host of the Revision Path Podcast. Revision Path is a weekly interview podcast showcasing some of the best Black graphic designers, web designers, and web developers out there. Maurice and I talk about the podcast, his career, and more, all right after this. Are you ready for an adventure? Then get your Creative South Adventure ticket today. This is the ticket for you. It's a full day of adventure that includes catered breakfast at the National Infantry Museum with a tour following, a bike tour down the Riverwalk on the Chattahoochee, catered lunch at the Civil War Naval Museum with a tour after that, finishing your bike ride at the zip line that crosses over the river to the high ropes course, whitewater rafting down the largest urban whitewater course in the world, ending with a wild game dinner at Epic with s'mores by fire on an island. That's all Tuesday, April 4th. This also includes an invite to the VIP dinner Wednesday night, as well as everything that comes with the regular ticket. A full vacation and an adventure in one day. Are you ready? We've gone through and streamlined the Creative South Podcast Patreon page, cleaning out the excess and making it easier for you to support us. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South Podcast swag. Every dollar helps cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please help support the podcast and become a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Maurice, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here on the show.
And I hope you're, since it's nice and early in the morning, I hope you're filled with coffee, and we'll kick it off with that caffeine induced. Where'd you grow up?
I'm originally from Selma, Alabama. So
my neck of the woods.
Yeah, you're in Alabama too, so I'm South Central Alabama, born and raised. Grew up there. When I was 18, moved here to Atlanta to start school at Morehouse College, and have kind of stayed here ever since.
Gotcha. So when you were growing up, especially in Selma, was design something you were even aware of at that point?
I was aware of, I don't know if I would have called it design at that point. I was doing a lot of things creatively. I was doing music. I was big into music. My brother, my older brother, he is a artist. Like, he paints, he sculpts, he draws, does a bunch of stuff. And I drew and wrote. I did a lot of writing and everything. So I did a lot of creative endeavors. I don't know if I would have categorized any of it, you know, specifically as design. I think the closest thing that I did growing up that I would probably call design was doing some form of computer graphics and working with Photoshop and Adobe PageMaker, which now is InDesign. See, I'm dating myself, but
yeah. Hey, I remember those days as well. In high school, I hated PageMaker. That thing was such a piece of crap.
Yeah, in high school, I used PageMaker to design our school newspaper. So I think that was probably my first big foray into some public facing type of design, is doing stuff like that. So yeah.
Sure. So when you get out of school, you said you went to Atlanta to go to Morehouse. What did you study up there, and what was your time like while you were in school?
Oh man. So my wanting to go to Morehouse was mostly fueled by me wanting to get out of Alabama. It was more about me leaving the state than about going to the school, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
I just kind of, you know, it's 18. You're at that time when you kind of want to, you know, spread your wings, and you want to just do new things and try and experience new things. And this is right around the time, you know, for me in high school, this is like the mid 90s, where the internet was really starting to, you know, become a thing. And so you had the opportunity to visit world outside of just your four walls in terms of exposure to different things. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it. My mother could probably tell you. She worked at a college, and I would be at the computer lab. I'd be at the computer lab in college, just soaking in everything I could in terms of reading and videos and music and all sorts of stuff. So it was more about me wanting to just get out and see the world. And to me, the world kind of was Atlanta, because, you know, when you're in the South, particularly in a small town, Atlanta's kind of it. Like, it's the biggest town everything.
It's the Mecca of the South.
Yeah. So I went to Morehouse. I studied computer science and computer engineering initially, like my first semester, and then I quickly switched over to math because I wanted to work with the web. All throughout elementary school, middle school, high school, I worked with computers, starting with like the Laser 50, working up to Apple IIe, to the Macintosh. I was always doing something with computers, learning BASIC, doing you know, computer graphics. Like I said, you know, I worked with PageMaker and things. And at the time, I really wanted to start to do things on the web. I wanted to make websites. I had already cut my teeth with doing things with Tripod and Angel Fire and making little web pages and stuff like that. And I wanted to do it for a living. But, you know, Morehouse at the time did not have the curriculum that supported that. Now, this is right around 1999, 2000. Mm-hmm. So there weren't really any schools that had any sort of web-based curriculum, or curriculum, I should say, that told you how to create websites and learn JavaScript and all this sort of stuff. You just sort of learned from reverse engineering what was already out there.
A lot of directed studies classes.
Yeah. And so my advisor at the time for computer science just sort of said, you know, if you want to work with the web, this is not the major for you, because we don't do that here, what he said. And so math was kind of my next choice, because I loved math. I was captain of the mathletes in high school, captain of our Mu Alpha Theta chapter. I was really good at math, took AP Calc, all that sort of stuff.
You're like, capturing full-on nerd cred here.
and was like, yeah, I should just do math. Because in my mind, I was thinking, if I've already done this math, because I actually, to kind of preface this a little earlier, I left to go from Selma to Atlanta like 2 weeks after I graduated high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I started at Morehouse in the summer as part of a summer program, my scholarship, which was through NASA and the Project Space program. So I had already been taking Cal 2, Cal 3, et cetera. And I thought, well, if I switch to math, I've already got these math credits, I could graduate quicker. That's the way I was thinking of it. Let me take that back. I was thinking, yes, I could graduate quicker, but also I really liked math. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking I could just take a subject that I really like and graduate early, and then, you know, I guess figure something out after that. I didn't really have a plan. My only plan was just to get out and graduate, because also at the time I was getting tired of school.
Sure.
And it's like, you know, this is sort of the last hurdle that I felt like I needed to cross. So I switched over to math, graduated in 3.5 years. And
wow.
Yeah, that was that.
So obviously you're smart if you get through and determined to get through that quickly.
I mean, I don't like to say that about myself. I mean, I just really like math. I'll just put it like that. Yeah, because when you, three and when a half you start years, saying stuff like that, people, you know, I just like math. I'll just say that.
I'm not using it to hold you up to any standard. I'm just impressed that you got through college in 3.5 years. So, I mean, I will say, you know, I started college and had a little too much fun and didn't go to class nearly enough. And they asked me to leave after my first year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Doing great there. But when I got back in college, like pretty much all my credits that I had taken, I mean, maybe like in that first year, maybe 4 or 5 transferred over.
Yeah.
So when I got back in college, I got through in 3.5 years, I think. So all told, it was 4.5 years, but that first year was very much a wash. So I definitely understand that. But there is a motivation that comes with that.
There is. And I mean, I don't want to make it seem like my whole time going through Morehouse was a cakewalk, because it wasn't. Sure. If I counted those 3 months or so before, you know, the actual semester started in August, and it would have been a full 4 years. So I'll say that first. Right. Secondly, as I think any freshman in the Atlanta University Center, which is the consortium of HBCUs here in Atlanta that's made up of Morehouse, Spelman, Clark Atlanta, Morris Brown College at the time, the Interdenominational Theological Center, and Morehouse School of Medicine. But as any AUC freshman will tell you, when you get there that first year, there is so much temptation that you really have to be disciplined to get through that first year. I remember being at freshman
orientation. That's called college.
Well, yeah, but I remember being at freshman orientation and, you know, the dean of the freshmen at the time was saying, you know, like, look to your left and look to your right. You know, by the end of the semester, one of you won't be here. And it's like, what's this, like, the Hunger Games or something? You know, like, is it that bad? But there is a lot of temptation because it's just, you know, of course, I think it's just the regular college experience of being on your own, but you're also in a really big city that's known for entertainment. You've got all these other colleges literally right next door to you.
Sure.
So there's a huge student body. The campuses are pretty open, so you can walk between them very easily. You can very easily get on the bus. If you know someone that has a car, you can very easily leave campus because it's sort of nestled inside of the neighborhood. It's not really set off like some colleges are, like off, you know, from a residential area or something. It's kind of right there in the neighborhood. So it's very easy to get caught up. And nobody is really going to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. So you have to sort of have that self-discipline, I think, pretty early on. And for me, my first year was rough. My first year was plagued with issues. And I wanted to transfer. I wanted to go to the local art institute here and study design. And I was trying to see if my scholarship would transfer over. It wouldn't. And so I kind of had to find a way to just make it work. I had to, you know, as Tim Gunn would say on Project Runway, I had to have a make it work moment. And so I had to kind of find a way to make it work because my mom, you know, I came from a single parent household and my mom didn't have the money. She didn't have the money to send me to Morehouse. I mean, Morehouse is a pretty expensive school.
I was about to say, it's not cheap.
Yeah. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to get scholarships. And if I would have transferred, I would have had to pay out of pocket. So I had to find a way to make it work for myself, to just find ways to get through the experience. And honestly, once I got past my first year, it did get a lot easier. It certainly got easier after my second year when I was able to move off campus. And then it was much easier because then I looked at school as sort of the job that I had to do.
Sure.
So I'd leave my apartment, go down to campus, do what I need to do, and then I'm out.
Mm-hmm. So you go through, you graduate as a math major. What do you end up doing after college? Because, I mean, I realize there's math that's in programming, and you know, programming is a math language.
Yeah.
But is that what you end up doing, is start just programming straight out of college?
No, I sold tickets at the local symphony.
Okay. So, how does that happen?
Okay. So it happens because, like I said earlier, I didn't have a plan. I just majored in what I liked. I didn't have any sort of plan post-college as to what I would do. I kind of was going by the seat of my pants. And my math department really didn't prepare me in any sort of way to say, well, these are careers that you could do in math. They just wanted to point you towards going to graduate school to get your master's degree in math, which I didn't want to do because I'm like, look, I'm kind of fed up with school. I need a break. Are there any jobs that I could do? And they're like, well, you could be a math teacher. I'm like, yeah, I don't really want to teach. Is there something I can do with the web with math? And they're like, oh, I don't know if those two things really go together. You know, keep in mind, early 2000s. They're like, I don't know if these two things really go together. At the time, I was doing work study with the computer science department. And so I know that there were companies that were coming through the computer science department doing interviews like Microsoft, Real Player, et cetera. Again, early 2000s. And because I was working in the office, I managed to get myself inside of the interview book. So I did manage to interview, you know, my junior and senior year with some colleges. I'm sorry, with some companies, which is a really good thing. Also, kind of what ended up derailing me a bit was partially it was my scholarship program. So I mentioned earlier that I had a NASA scholarship to go to Morehouse. And so the first two summers, I was able to work at two different NASA facilities as an intern. One, Ames Research Center out in Moffett Field, California.
Sure.
And the second one was in Alabama at Marshall Space Flight Center.
Oh, okay.
And so I kind of was thinking, you know, well, I guess I could work for NASA after I graduated, since it seems like that's where the program was pushing me. And then 9/11 happened.
Ooh.
And when that happened, they ended up sort of shifting funding away from the program. So any sort of employment opportunities that might have been lined up for me after I graduated because of my scholarship program were completely gone. So I had to kind of do the computer science interview thing as a backup, which was good. I mean, it got to hone my interview skills. I did get to interview with, you know, Microsoft and, you know, Real Networks and Oracle and all these other places. But, you know, it wasn't getting a job because I wasn't a computer science major and I didn't have that programming language.
Sure.
And so I was working a part-time job, you know, at the time, selling tickets at the local symphony. And that's what I did after I graduated. I remember I graduated on Sunday, went to work on Monday.
So how do you get from there to where you are today?
A series of lucky events, I think. So I was working at the symphony, and, you know, the one thing with working at the symphony, and I think with anyone that works in any sort of a box office, is you just have a lot of time to sit and think, you know.
Sure.
Because the symphonies, they only take place, you know, 3 or 4 nights out of the week. It's at night. So if you're there during the day, nobody's really buying tickets. You just have a lot of time to sit and think about, well, what's my next step going to be? After I ended up leaving selling tickets, I worked at Auto Trader for a short while as a telemarketer, kind of doing, you know, customer servicey type of stuff.
And with, sounds fun.
It was great. And after and they had this dealer concierge program, which is sort of like a trial program where you would sort of get to do more, I guess it would be more customer service type stuff, but I was trying to move more into being a business analyst because I was looking at kind of the work that they were doing, and I said I could learn that. You know, it was learning some MySQL stuff and Toad, and I was like, I can learn that. It's not a problem. It ended up not working out in my favor going towards doing that route, and I ended up getting fired. And I did, you know, a lot of odd jobs between getting fired from there and getting my first web job. I was a telemarketer for the opera for a day. Yeah, just for a day. And the reason it was only a day long was because in the little room that they had us working in, they had a CD player that played Boys to Men, I'll Make Love to You on repeat for like hours.
Oh, that'll drive you crazy.
And like I went home and I put all the stuff that they gave me inside a big envelope and just mailed it back to them and never went back.
I can't blame you. So eight hours of Boys to Men, one song.
I'd hate that
any
song.
Any sane person.
Right. So I did a series of you know, odd jobs that did stuff like that. I did math tutoring online, just a bunch of random jobs just to kind of make ends meet. And then we have a local alt weekly here called Creative Loafing.
Yeah.
And in the back of Creative Loafing, they had an ad for an electronic media specialist position at the Georgia World Congress Center. And I applied on a whim. I actually had a pretty decent portfolio at this point because I was still doing web stuff. I was just doing it on the side. I was doing it for friends and things like that. And so I actually had a fairly decent portfolio of work to show them. Went and interviewed. They liked me. And that was my actual first web job in 2005, was being the electronic media specialist for the Georgia World Congress Center, which for those that are listening that are familiar with it, it's actually a big multi-venue facility. It's the Georgia Dome. It's the Georgia World Congress Center where conferences and conventions are held. And it's Centennial Olympic Park, and they're all connected. So I was the electronic media specialist for all three of those venues, which meant being the webmaster over all the websites, designing the websites, doing content strategy, doing everything from making multimedia CDs to controlling the big marquees out on the side of the road to the internal wayfinding system. To PowerPoints, Word documents, Illustrator stuff, Photoshop. I mean, no 2 days were different with that position. I was doing a lot of different stuff.
It sounds like it. Yeah. I had a friend who worked for the World Congress, doing a similar position, probably around the same time as you. And he would always, I went to high school with him, and he always talked about just the how kind of almost chaotic it was, the variation.
Yeah. I mean, it was chaotic, but I liked the chaos in it because I was learning so much different stuff. Like, I don't think I would have, now that I think of, you know, kind of hindsight is 2020, I don't think I've had any position that has had that level of variety of the type of work that you're doing. Like, one day you might be doing PowerPoints, the next day you might be putting together, you know, a EPK for an exhibitor, which is an electronic press kit, or you might be editing the venue maps in Illustrator, or you might be doing the wayfinding system because there's this new conference coming in, you know, the city. So you're always doing something different, something new, and I loved that variety of work.
Gotcha. So what do you end up doing after the Georgia World Congress Center?
So left the Congress Center and ended up working for AT&T for a little while. Worked there as a junior designer, then worked my way up to being a senior designer. Did that from like mid-2006 to late 2008. And that was an experience. I don't want to say it was all bad. I mean, looking back on it, there were things that I gained from that experience which were good, which was the speed at which I can now generate ideas, the speed at which I can code. I certainly honed all of that during that time, but it's very much a high quantity production based environment, which I didn't know going into it.
Sure.
So you're like cranking out ad graphics, you're cranking out websites, I mean, on a really, really quick level. And there's no templates, it's all coded from scratch, HTML, CSS, no JavaScript, because this was, I think this was like 2006, 2008-ish. So we weren't really using a lot of JavaScript or jQuery or anything like that. Yeah, that was a really interesting time. I was working like 12-hour days, cranking out work. And I remember they had this whiteboard where they would have everyone's sort of statistics on, very much kind of like a Glengarry, Glenn Ross type of situation.
Oh, no.
So every time you completed graphics or you completed websites, you got these certain point values. And the point values would just add up. So you would see if you're on the red team, you got this much. If you're on the white team, you got this much. If you're on the blue team, you got this much or whatever. And so you have that like weird level of competition, even though you're all at the same level, getting paid peanuts, cranking out this work. And, you know, that level of competition ends up fostering enmity between your coworkers when it's like we're all kind of in this together, but yet you see how you're ranked. And that does weird things to people who don't even know you, who are supposed to be your coworkers.
It breeds a lot of animosity.
Yeah, it ends up breeding a lot of unnecessary animosity, which unfortunately, I mean, I've been gone from that job now for over 8 years, and I still run into some of those people that still hold that with them. And it's like, let it
shooting
go.
You the stink eye.
Yeah, like let it go. Like Elsa said, let it go. Just it's not that serious, you know. But yeah, ended up leaving there. I quit there actually, and then started my studio after that.
So when you quit, and your studio is Lunch, right? Okay. First off, why the name Lunch? I love it. I'm just curious why the name Lunch.
It was initially 318 Media. It was the number 3, the word 18 Media. That was the first name for it. It had sort of an odd spelling, which you would be surprised how many web forms will not take a company name that begins with a number. So that kind of ended up being a bit of an issue. Also, here in Atlanta, there's several 3 blank blank medias. There's a 360 Media that does PR. I've worked with them.
Sure.
There's a 352 Media. I'm 318 Media. And it's confusing. I think it would probably be confusing for them. It certainly ended up being confusing for me. And I just kind of got tired of the name. And I changed it in 2015 to Lunch. Because I just wanted it to be something simpler. I wanted it to be something which I felt was easy to remember. And that also kind of encompassed, I think, the general type of whimsy that I wanted the studio to have. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I ended up changing it to Lunch.
So what do you do at Lunch? What is, I mean, obviously a lot of web design, but kind of your overall encompassing this. What does Lunch do?
So I like to say that Lunch is a multidisciplinary creative studio because we do web, we do graphic, we do, you know, branding, identity work, do a lot of WordPress stuff. We do a lot of work with MailChimp, like MailChimp templates and things. But then we also, you know, on occasion, we'll do some video work depending on if we're working with, you know, one of our partners. Or we do audio work, of course. You know, I'm a podcaster as well. I have a podcast called Revision Path. But before I did Revision Path, I've actually been podcasting for about 10 years.
Oh,
so
wow.
So I've been doing, you know, little shows.
So you got in early on.
Yeah, so I've been doing little shows here and there and decided I would bring that knowledge, you know, kind of to my business. You know, earlier in about 2006 to 2009, there was the Georgia Podcast Network. And so podcasting was pretty big in and around Georgia, and then it sort of petered off, and now it started to come back as this resurgence. So I wanted to be able to bring that knowledge of how to put together a show, how to edit your show, how to make your show more popular or what have you. I would bring that as well. So we kind of do a little bit of everything along those lines.
We'll talk after this and you can help me help me with my show.
All right.
So you've been doing Lunch for, if my math is right, about 8 years now.
Yep, 8 years.
What's been the kind of most challenging aspect of running your own agency?
Wow. Where to begin? The most challenging aspect is really, for me, it's been keeping consistent clients. Because I think, you know, the way that the market has changed in terms of tools and in terms of the leveling of the playing field for people to get into doing design, it gives clients a lot more choices for people to go with. And sure. And oftentimes, you know, the client may like you, but for them, it's not just about whether or not they know, like, and trust you. It's oftentimes a cost issue. And sure. So I know there certainly have been times where I've lost out on clients that I've had for a long time because they're budgeting and they found someone that could do maybe similar services halfway around the world for much cheaper. And despite the fact that I've worked with them for 5 years, they want to give this other, you know, agency or something a try, which it's like, well, I mean, I don't want to undercut my services for what I'm doing, but in the same vein, that's kind of been an issue where, you know, clients will come and they're shopping on price. They know what they want, hopefully, mostly know what they want based on how I might go through my onboarding process, but it will still kind of boil down to cost for them. And I'm not saying I'm you know, super expensive or anything, but I would like to think that I'm comparable with what's out there on the
market.
But
you're not Fiverr.
Right, no, but I'm not Fiverr. And clients will learn about Fiverr and they're like, oh, well, you're charging this much, but, you know, this person in Bangladesh can do it for $5. And I'll just say, well, go get it for $5 then. Like, I'm not going to try to compete with that. If you really are,
yeah,
like,
there's no need to.
If you want to get the $5 logo, get the $5 logo. That's fine. You know, you get what you pay for, but, you know, it's kind of a trial and error sort of thing. But yeah, that's been the most difficult thing kind of going forward because my profile has risen as my company has gone on. And so my rates have gone up, not astronomically, but they have gone up, you know, a little bit every year. And so keeping clients on that same consistent level can be a challenge when, you know, they're looking at Squarespace and they're looking at, you know, Webflow and other types of services and thinking, well, I could do that. You know, I'm like, okay, well, my thing with clients is to try to let them know that going with me is, you know, a way for them to buy their time back. It's a way for them to spend time with their family, spend time with, you know, their loved ones or something like that. But it does oftentimes boil down to cost. And so that can be kind of a big issue.
Sure. Excuse me. So, you know, you mentioned the, you know, working in some of the audio stuff that you do. At what point did you decide to start Revision Path from all the other podcasting stuff and from building, you know, your business out?
Oh, that's a good question. I initially had the idea to do Revision Path in 2006. In 2004, I started this internet event called the Black Weblog Awards, which was my answer to the blog. I don't know if you remember the bloggies. that kind of were going on around that time. That was sort of my answer to the bloggies, because I knew that there were black bloggers and podcasters and video bloggers out there doing really great work and you know, doing insightful pieces, but they just weren't getting any kind of recognition from the general kind of blogosphere intelligentsia, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I started the event as a way to showcase them. Right around 2006, as I'm sort of adding new categories and things like that, I add a best design blog, which was going to be my way for, you know, designers that I knew to sort of add their kind of two cents into this. Because sure. I always wanted to have a way to showcase, you know, the work that we're doing. Because if there's one thing that I knew from me and all my peers at the time, we were not getting the same type of opportunities. We're not getting the same type of recognition. We're kind of slaving away doing the same type of work, but just not getting any kind of credit for it. And nobody's showing us any sort of, you know, they don't know that we're there. And also there's that issue of not knowing if there are other black designers. So they feel like they're alone in doing this, even though we might be friends. It's like, well, are we it? Are there other black designers out there in the void? You know, that kind of thing. And so with 2013, it was sort of the mix of it being the right time and me having the right resources to really kind of end up making it happen. And I sold the Black Web Blog Awards in 2011. That was right when I turned 30, and I was like, I'm selling it so I can sort of get my life back again and have free time. And, you know, did that for about 2 years, and then that itch came where it's like, I need to start a new project. And Revision Path was kind of what that would be. And when I started it off, it was always going to be interview-based. I'll say that. It was going to be long-form, maybe, you know, 1,500, 2,000-word long-form interviews with black designers, and it would go into, you know, their methodology and how they got into the industry and all this sort of stuff. And from there, it sort of morphed into a podcast, like right around March of 2014, because of what happened is some people would do the long written interviews, and some people would just say, well, can we just get on the phone and talk? I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I've got Skype, we can do that. And so I had some audio interviews and I had some, you know, text interviews, and I was like, it's actually much easier to do the audio. Let me just switch and do a podcast. And
that's why I do a podcast.
Yeah. So that's how the podcast was born. Episode 15 or 16, I think, was March of 2014. That's when I kind of officially kicked it off as a weekly show. And it's been going ever since.
Gotcha. So for people who aren't familiar with Revision Path, kind of give them the breakdown of what you do. I know you've kind of summed it up a little bit through us talking, but you know, the general overview, I guess.
Sure. So Revision Path is a weekly showcase of the world's black web designers, graphic designers, web developers. I don't necessarily limit it to just those particular titles, because titles have changed so much, you know.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are product designers, there's UI people, there's UX people, there's presentation specialists, there's experience designers, there's
visual designers.
Yeah, visual designers, creative directors, art directors, so many people. So I try to, you know, keep it within the realm of design as much as I can. I do, and I would say in the past, I have had on occasion, you know, more tech type people. So software developers or, you know, people that do big data or things like that, kind of, you know, bringing them into the fold a little bit, but still wanting to keep the focus about design. And so every week I interview these people. Interviews kind of run anywhere between, I try to keep it between 45 minutes to an hour. Sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's shorter. And it's one person a week, and we just talk about what they do. And it's not just here in the United States. I mean, I'd say probably the majority of the guests are here in the U.S., but I try to add a lot of variety into what I think could initially be seen as a monolithic group. When someone says, you know, black designers, that could be just anybody. But I try to really vary it based on age, based on location, on seniority level, on geography, sexual orientation, number of different things. I try to vary it. So we have a lot here in the U.S., but also I've interviewed designers in the Caribbean, in Europe, all throughout Africa, and I hope pretty soon to be interviewing some black designers in Asia and in South America. So I'm really trying to branch out and get a good view of the diaspora of design through the show.
Oh, good word.
Yeah.
That's a really good word. So, you know, throughout these conversations, you know, I know you're talking about work and all, but how often do you talk about, you know, the need for diversity and the importance of diversity out there in the industry?
You know, we talk about it, I would say, a fair bit. We talk about it as it comes up. I try not to have the focus of the show be a quote-unquote diversity show.
Sure.
I know that there are people that will look at the show just, you know, off face value and get that. And that's fine. But, you know, take some time to listen and you'll see that it's a lot more than just that.
Right.
We do talk about those issues as they arise. If someone wants to talk about their experience, and we do end up going into diversity in tech or diversity in design, we do end up discussing that. But I try not to make it my focus in each episode to touch on it. If we go there, we go there. If we don't, we don't. And oftentimes I try to leave the conversation open enough and make sure that the person is comfortable enough to just share whatever it is that they're comfortable with. And, you know, through that, you know, we go pretty deep sometimes where people will talk about kind of what their experiences have been like. And, you know, other times we've kept it, you know, fairly kind of geeky and light. So it varies. But I tried not to make it the central focus of the show or of any of the interviews. If it happens throughout the normal conversation, then we'll go into it. But I don't try to, like, force it in.
Sure. So, you know, you're talking to Black graphic designers and other people within the industry. Does that experience, I'll just put it out there, I'm a very white guy.
Okay.
How does that experience differ, at least in your perception, between the two?
I mean, I've never been a white guy, so that's hard for me to make that.
I've never been a Black guy.
Oh,
so
there you go. How is it different? I think, and I'm completely just kind of guessing and throwing it out there, but I think that my guests have just right off the bat a bit more comfort with me because I'm a Black host and they're Black and we can connect, I think, on that level.
Sure.
And so oftentimes the conversations can get, you know, a little raw, a little real, you know, very quickly because that level of connection has already been sort of innately made just off of, you know, that very kind of superficial thing. How do I think it's different? I don't know. I mean, I think that we talk a lot about, and not in every episode, but I certainly find myself talking a lot about the culture of design, and I talk about sort of where we fall into that as Black designers, whether that's the search for a particular Black design aesthetic, talking about how, you know, old stereotypes are still kind of perpetuated now through advertising and design. What does it mean when you see the absence of Black people in general design media, when you don't see us in the documentaries, in the magazines, in the blogs, in the podcasts, in the conferences? What is that? What signal does that send? You know, also, I can tell you one conversation we had is about celebrity creative directors. So we see a lot of Black celebrities being named as creative directors, Alicia Keys, Nick Cannon, Rihanna, Solange. I think most recently I saw the rapper Lil Yachty was creative director of Nautica. And it's like, what signal does that send to Black ACDs and CDs and designers in the field that want to get at that level, but they're not a super celebrity? You know, what kind of signal does that send? Like, we may talk about things like that. I don't know if that's something that people will find discussed on other design shows. Not that I'm you know, making that comparison, but I do like to add that bit of context and culture into the episodes when I'm talking to people.
Sure.
Just so we can sort of flesh that out and have that conversation, because that might not be a conversation that anyone else has heard. It might be a conversation maybe they've had with a coworker or a friend, but the fact that these are two other professionals having this conversation is like, oh, we talk about that too. Or it might give you some food for thought, like, wow, I never thought about that.
Well, I'd never thought of it from the race standpoint, but I have thought of it from the, you know, what is the purpose other than, you know, these people are perceived tastemakers, but that doesn't make a creative director.
Right.
Like, you know, being popular doesn't make a creative director from the job standpoint.
Yeah. And also, is it because of their skill or is it because they're a celebrity?
Yeah.
You know,
well, and that's what I always wonder is like,
does that creativity in one field innately transfer into another field? Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. So yeah, things like that.
Well, and a lot of times I feel that's more of a marketing ploy than it is an actual.
Oh, it totally is. Yeah.
Yeah.
let's get that clear. It totally is a marketing ploy. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I think there's no question about that. It's just, you know, how often are these people actually contributing versus just contributing their name?
Right. But then I think about the signal that sends, like, is that the level that I need to be? Do I need to be twice as good, five times as good, 10 times as good just to get to that level? Like, how am I supposed to level up that quickly? How am I supposed to get there? You know, I'm not a superstar like that. I mean, that's just one instance of a conversation that we might have, but that's something that we'll examine that, you know, I don't know if that would be examined if it's happening on another platform.
I hadn't thought of that. I certainly haven't had that conversation. I know that. and you know, not to like overly compare our shows, but I listened to a couple episodes and our show structures are fairly similar as far as the conversation path. But that wouldn't be a conversation that I probably would have. That's an interesting take on it.
Well, I do try to make sure that I get something. I don't want to say like get something interesting because it sounds like that I'm fishing for it. But but I mean, when I'm talking with people, you know, I'm often taking notes while we're talking. And so they may throw off something completely offhand that then I will use that to go further to talk about something else. So, for example, back in October of last year, I was fortunate enough to be invited to Facebook to do a series of interviews because Facebook is a sponsor of the show. And one of the women that I interviewed, Jacqueline Laurier, she kind of mentioned offhand that she was Ghanaian. She's from Ghana. And I've had other Ghanaians on the show. And so I'm you know, used that as kind of a sticking point to kind of delve a little bit further into like what that means for her as a designer, and you know, the conversation kind of bloomed from there. I don't know if it would have went there if, you know, I didn't even think to kind of bring that out in the conversation.
I hadn't thought of that. So when you're talking with people, what's the most important thing for you to find out?
I think the most important thing for me to find out is what is the spark that drives them. What is it that motivates them to do this? Because this industry, you know, for what it's worth, is not a kind industry. I'll say that.
No.
But I mean, it's not a kind industry in a number of different ways. I don't want to say that like, oh, there's a bunch of big meanies in design. I'm not saying it like that. It's not a kind industry for a number of things. One, you know, technology moves very fast.
Yes.
And so, you know, in a number of years, you can quickly get outpaced. It's a fairly young industry. And because of technology, it's sort of democratizing the field in terms of how people get into it. And so you could be super young and have a great portfolio that will beat out someone that maybe has 20 years on you that has been doing this for much longer. You know what I mean? There's that. Then there's also, I think, because it's a young industry, and technology kind of suffers from this as well. Technology definitely suffers from this as well. It's sort of the lack of learning about ethics as it relates to kind of the work that we do. And that has trickled down into discrimination, into sexism, into, you know, a number of different isms. Certainly, I think there's most people on the show, if you listen to the interviews, there might be one or two things they might mention about a bit of a difficulty that they had. And I'm not saying it necessarily stemmed from their race, but it very well could be a part of it just based on sort of what's celebrated and what's lauded in the industry today.
Mm-hmm. What do you think those things that are celebrated in the industry today?
White dudes, like 20 something white UX designers in Silicon Valley,
mm-hmm.
or London.
Yeah,
sorry, London.
I've noticed the same thing, I'm trying to find the right words here. But what do you think your show adds to that conversation? To what are you adding to that conversation to combat it? To showcase would be the better word. Other people in the industry.
Visibility. That's the main thing that I'm showcasing. You know, it's interesting. I do all the outreach for the show. Mm-hmm. I'd say 90% of the show is me just blindly emailing people.
Oh, good. I'm not the only one doing it.
And say, hey, would you like to come on the show? And, you know, we're just celebrating our fourth anniversary. We've done mm-hmm. well over 175 episodes, and it does not get easier. I wish I could tell you after 4 years that it gets easier and people are like, oh, I've heard your show. No, it's still just as bad. I mean, I think the side effect is that I'm like a whiz at cold emails. Like, I have no fear anymore.
I still haven't gotten that one done yet.
So I'll reach out to people, and people will reach out to me and say, oh, I should be on the show because of XYZ. And, you know, I want to think about, well, do they have a good story? Do they have something to say? You know, because some people just want to get on the show and promote their business or whatever. And it's like, yeah, sure. That's kind of boring. You know, if you want to do that, you can just buy an ad. You know, I don't want to have you on the show and you just talk about your business. I want you to talk about you as a professional and what your story mm-hmm. is and how you got here. And so I think that visibility is the most important thing for me, because past guests and people, you know, will write into the show and will say, you know, I never would have known about blank if you hadn't mentioned it on the show. Like, I never would have known about this person, or I never would have known about this type of design, or I never would have known people were doing design in this country if mm-hmm. if you hadn't reached out and talked to these people. So visibility definitely is the number one thing. I would say, out of, you know, all the people that I've had on the show, and like I say, I do my outreach completely blind. For many of them, this is their very first interview. This is the very first time that anyone has talked to them in a professional manner about the work that they've done. And so with them, they can sort of walk away with a press credit. They can walk away with something that can say, hey, this is, somebody saw my work and saw that I was, you know, good enough to talk to about this kind of thing. And that can be a big, I don't want to say ego boost, but that can be just kind of like a big boost to you personally, to say like, oh, wow, I could be doing this kind of work if I just, you know, kind of stick to it. And I've joined the company of all these other people that are doing it. So it has that kind of sort of byproduct effect.
So since visibility is such an issue, how are you finding guests that fit the mold?
You know, I try to do a number of different things. I'm always very cognizant of the parity, of gender parity on the show. I want to make sure that I try to get as close to 50-50 as I can. I don't know what the percentage is now. I need to probably go back and check. But I know that sometime in 2014? I think it was 2014. I was looking at the parody and was like, wow, I really need to have more women on the show. And so for like 3 months, it was all women on the show. Mm-hmm. I was just like, I'll just do that, because I can do that, because it's my show. I can just turn that direction. And nobody said boo about it. Actually, I think that was probably one of the bigger spikes that we've had in terms of listenership, because they could look and see all these dope black women doing a number of different types of design and, you know, the work that they're doing. Anything from being a design educator to an entrepreneur to, you know, I remember this one woman, Alicia Carr. She was episode 95. She started learning how to code in her 50s. She's a grandmother.
Oh, wow.
Learned how to code in her 50s. Apple invited her to WWDC. Now she's like an iOS developer and loves it. Absolutely loves it, you know. I don't know if that story would have really been told anywhere else if I could have had her on the show, and to inspire other people, to let them know, you know, you don't have to be this young 20-something to be in this industry. You can pick this up and try to learn this stuff whenever you can. So don't let that, you know, be a hindrance to you.
Right.
I don't know if I'm looking for any sort of special type of they gotta be black, but I mean, other than that, I don't, I'm trying to think, is there any kind of special, it's weird because I just, when I'm looking at people that I want to have on the show, I have to think like, is this person going to have something to say? Like, are they going to have a story? You know, maybe I will look at their LinkedIn profile and see what their work history is, or I'll look at their Twitter and kind of get an idea. It's very much this kind of black box thinking. I don't have some sort of strict algorithm where I'm saying, oh, well, this person has been in the industry for 5 years and they've worked at these places, so they'll be perfect for the show. That's not necessarily a good formula, because those people can come on and be super dry and it's like, it's boring. They have no personality. You can't break them out of work mode. So I just try to switch it up. I try to really switch it up. I try to switch things up. You know, if I've got too many men on the show, I'll switch to have women on the show. If I have too many women on the show, I'll switch to have more men on the show. If I feel like I'm doing too many here in the U.S., well, let me start doing more international interviews. You know, I try to just keep it, you know, fresh the whole time. So I'm thinking, how can I make the next interview different from the former interview? That's kind of how I'm always thinking with keeping it, you know, kind of in a very diverse way. Just thinking each way. I mean, it's very much intentional. I will say that.
Sure.
I'm doing it completely intentionally.
Yeah. Well, I asked that question because, you know, I'm always trying to find more diversity to bring on this show. And, you know, part of it is, again, going back to, I'm a white guy, so I'm not always aware of where to look to find people who have a story to tell. And like you said, I don't want to bring somebody on. This is going to sound horrible. I don't want to bring somebody on just because they're black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want them to have a story to tell as well, because, you know, it's a show and I don't want people to be bored. And there's, you know, people out there of all races and colors that are plenty boring that I could find. So that's why I was asking that question, is because I feel that I need to have more diversity on my show, not just to have diversity, but to have more viewpoints shown and more, you know. I don't know what the right word is.
Well, I mean, you know, with that, I mean, and this is, you know, to any design podcaster that's out there listening, I mean, you want to start with the reason on why it's important to you. Like,
sure.
What's the personal reason it's important? You know, if you're just saying you want to have more diversity because it would make the show look better, I mean, that's a very superficial reason. I'm not saying that for you. I'm just saying if someone says that, it's a very superficial reason. Like, there has to be some intent behind it. Like, what is having these different voices going to bring, you know, personally to me? You know, because it's not just about what's going to be on the show. I mean, you're talking to these people. With each episode that you have, you are building your network of people that you know trademark in this industry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you think about the personal reason as to why you want to have more diversity. And again, you know, diversity is not just about race. I mean, you know, I'm focusing on black people because I'm a black designer and that's the focus of my show. Sure. But, you know, diversity is a spectrum. It's not just, you know, about race. It's not just about gender. It's geography. It's sexual orientation. It's ableness. It's a number of different things. And so think about why diversity is important to you on that personal level. And I think it becomes a lot easier for you to seek out the diversity that you're looking for. I mean, it does have to be an intentional thing. I will say that. I know there are a lot of, I don't want to say there's a lot of design podcasters that do this, but there are some shows and things I know. It's sort of like a field of dreams situation. Well, you know, if I just build it, they will come to me, and that it just doesn't work that way. You have to go and seek it out. You got to go find it.
Sure.
Now, I'll tell you,
it would make our jobs a lot easier if people would just come seek us out.
Oh, I mean, it certainly would. But, like, you know, like, personally, I don't have any kind of special research powers. I'd say 95% of the people on the show, I found them on LinkedIn.
Okay.
I got a regular free LinkedIn account. I search people. I look through their connections. I search more people. I may spend like a good hour or two on LinkedIn and just start adding people in a spreadsheet. And of course, as the show has grown, people have contacted me. And so that helps for me to add people in. Every time I interview someone on the show, I ask them if there's someone that they know that they think I should interview. And so that warm referral also really helps out, because they'll know some people, and that will help me to kind of build my list out. So with each episode, as it keeps going and as time goes, my list of potentials just grows and grows and grows and grows. In 2014, I actually started an offshoot to the site called 28 Days of the Web, which was something that I wanted to do in February in conjunction with and in celebration of Black History Month. So with 28 Days of the Web, it's similar to Revision Path, but this is a daily thing. And it's okay. And it's not podcast. It's just profiles of people. So it's, and the good thing is because it's 28 days, you get 14 men, 14 women. Boom. and so each day it's a different person that alternates, and you see their picture, their website, their Twitter profile, and a bio. And so it, I have it. It goes out on Twitter, goes out on Facebook. This year it'll go out on Instagram. I was really late getting on the Instagram boat. no, it was so funny because I was at Facebook in October, and like we went to the to part of the campus where Instagram is, and they have these stages set up. And the guy was like, "Yeah, you know, you can take your, you know, get your phone out, take some pictures for Instagram." And I'm like, "I'm not on Instagram." And it was like you could hear the record screech by saying that inside the Instagram building that you're not on Instagram. I'm like, "Yeah, I should probably." I'll get on that when I get back to Atlanta, but like right now, this is nice. This is cool. Thank you for showing me this, you know?
Quietly back out of the room.
Exactly. But so I had so many people from doing, you know, kind of these potential, like have this potential list of guests and things that I wanted to kind of give folks another opportunity to be showcased. And so now we're, you know, going to our fourth year of doing 28 Days of the Web. So every day in February, there's, you know, a different profile, and it goes out, it tweets out to the person as well. So they get to see it, and they get to see their name and profile and picture among all these others. Like, I think now we're at well over 100 now. So, yeah, it's been a good thing. And it's just another opportunity to showcase the diversity that's in the industry and also to spotlight these people that might not have another chance in any other way to be seen.
Gotcha. Excuse me. So we're kind of getting close to our time, but I wanted to ask, you know, with these different avenues, you know, what are your goals moving forward?
Oh man, I would love to do Revision Path full time. That's that is the goal. I had to sit with myself over Christmas and really think about it. I would love to do this full time because as I've done Revision Path, different opportunities have presented themselves to me that I don't think would have come had I not done this. Like, I don't think I would have had a chance to be at Facebook. Like, Facebook invited me out to speak and to record out there. I don't think that would have happened if I was just doing WordPress templates. I just don't think it would have happened.
No.
But also the network of people that I built, and some of these people have, you know, become really close friends of mine. I've been able to build a community. We have a Slack community around the podcast. It has about 300 or so people in it. We've got a job board. We've got a blog. Like, it's been able to grow more from doing this, like the number of opportunities and things. And people have said, because of the show, they've been able to meet this other designer, or they've been able to learn about this new profession that they go into, or they've gotten a job, or, you know, all sorts of things. You know, I've some people even send me pictures of meetups that they've had with other Revision Path listeners. And it always blows my mind because I'm like, I'm just doing this from my apartment. You know, it's funny. I call it, I tell people I'm recording from Studio B because the B stands for bedroom, but like, I'm just doing this from my apartment. Like, to me, it still feels like this fairly small ish kind of thing. Cause I don't feel like the general design community has really latched onto it as they have with other shows. But throughout the show, I've been able to meet so many people here in the US, internationally. I've been able to get the attention of companies. Our podcast is also on the AIGA website, which is something a lot of, you know, that's a pretty big deal. I mean, it's my show and it's Debbie Millman's Design Matters. Like,
yeah,
it's a pretty big deal. And I just started my show in 2013, you know? So the amount of visibility that I've been able to gain for these people, and I think also kind of, you know, for myself, I say for myself as kind of an ancillary benefit.
Sure.
One thing that I think when I did the show, I didn't want it to be about me in terms of like my face on the cover and all this sort of stuff. I'm like, it's really about the people that I'm showcasing. It's about them. This is their opportunity to shine. And I'm just sort of the conduit that will help that happen. And so I mean, I've certainly gotten, you know, an ancillary benefit from doing this, but I would like to be able to do this full time and really devote as much time as I can to building this platform out and having it become more sustainable for years to come. That's my primary goal right now.
Awesome. Well, good luck with that. When you figure out how to do that, let me know. I'm in the same boat as you. I would love to be able to take the podcast full time. It's a lot of fun, and it's like you said, there's those ancillary benefits where it's that community building and things like that that come from it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So, well, wrapping up real quickly, where can people find you online?
Well, I am at mauricecherry.com. It's just my first name, last name, mauriceccherry, like the fruit.com. On there, there's links to me on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Tumblr. I have a fairly active Tumblr blog that I keep, as well as my office hours are on there as well. I do like this Friday office hours kind of thing. Revision Path is at revisionpath.com. You can also find it on Twitter at Revision Path. You can find it on Facebook, facebook.com/revisionpath, and on Instagram, just instagram.com/revisionpath. And then 28 Days of the Web is at 28, just the number 28, 28daysoftheweb.com. And then it's also 28 Days of the Web on Twitter as well.
Awesome. Well, Maurice, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I appreciate it. You can find out more about Maurice on Twitter at Maurice Cherry, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Creative SO Pod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Creative South GA, over at CreativeSouth.com, and I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram.
For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at Patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.